Safe. You can find this study and more just like it covering all kinds of infectious diseases at sidrap.umn.edu. For the Minnesota Dose on KFAI, I'm Ryan Dawes.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and around the world at kfai.org. The community's true voice.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
This is Minnesota Native News Community Health Conversations with hosts Leah Lim and Dr. Anthony Stately. Community Health Conversations is supported by the Minnesota Department of Health.
Anine, hello. I'm Leah Lim.
And I'm Anthony Stately. We're back with more conversations, more explorations about how healthcare in Indian Country is responding and adapting beyond the COVID-19 pandemic. Miigwech, and thank you all for joining us.
Buju, Dr. Stately, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay today. It's sunny and it's beautiful, so I'm happy.
That's great. Well, I'm very excited for today's conversation. We are speaking with Dr. Melissa Walls. Dr. Walls is the director of the Great Lakes Hub for the Johns Hopkins Center for American Indian Health, and is an associate professor of American Indian Health in the Department of International Health. Her involvement in community-based participatory research projects includes mental health epidemiology, culturally relevant family-based substance use prevention, mental health promotion, programming, and evaluation, as well as examining the impact of stress and mental health on diabetes. Dr. Walls has a PhD in sociology, and as a public health scholar, she approaches all these projects at the intersection of what's morally, ethically, and community-centered. But first, let's catch up a bit about where we are.
Currently, roughly 13% of the population of Minnesota is up to date on their vaccine doses. Staying up to date with vaccines remains the safest strategy for preventing COVID-19 hospitalizations and death.
And although COVID-19 is no longer considered a public health emergency, currently there are over 1 million positive cases, including reinfections. So again, taking those preventative measures we've mentioned in recent episodes are still helpful for the overall health of our community.
And COVID-19 does not discriminate based on race, where you come from, your immigration status, or anything else. If you have experienced or witnessed an incident of discrimination or bias, call Minnesota's Discrimination Helpline at 1-833-454-0148.
And the age groups most affected by COVID-19, influenza, and RSV this season are those in the 65-plus group and children 4 years old and younger. If you are curious to know the immunization schedule for any given age group, visit cdc.gov/vaccines.
There is still a lot to learn about COVID-19 and long COVID. For many people, long COVID symptoms will gradually improve over time. For others, symptoms may progressively get worse and could become permanent. The best way to prevent long COVID is to avoid getting infected or reinfected with the virus that causes COVID-19.
And if you have a chronic illness like diabetes, high blood pressure, asthma, or cancer, it is important to get regular checkups and take your prescription medications regularly. Managing your chronic illness can help you fight off other illnesses such as COVID-19 or the flu. Don't you agree, Dr. Stately?
Absolutely. I think everybody probably remembers, we've talked about this a number of times on our shows and our conversations. I found out I was diabetic actually when I got COVID and went to the hospital. So I think probably my rapid decline once I got COVID was probably related to my undiagnosed diabetes, which the two of them together kind of like took me down quickly and fairly rapidly. And that was a dark time in my life. I talked a whole lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you got better.
Me too. Me too.
You're listening to Minnesota Native News Community Health Conversations. This program is supported by the Minnesota Department of Health. Find information about COVID vaccines and boosters online at mn.gov/COVID-19. Today, we're excited to be speaking with Dr. Melissa Walls. Dr. Walls is the director of the Great Lakes Hub for the Johns Hopkins Center for Indigenous Health and is Associate Professor of American Health in the Department of International Health.
Buju, we're happy to have joining us Dr. Melissa Walls. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
Buju, it's great to see you. Doing really well. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, can you please introduce yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Memengwan Ndishinakaz, Migizi Duodam, International Falls Nindunjaba. I'm Melissa Walls, and I'm a professor at Johns Hopkins University. I grew up right on that border of Minnesota and Ontario in a town called International Falls. And on my mom's side, I'm Bois Fort and Kuchiching First Nation Ojibwe. And then on my dad's side, I'm a German-Swedish mix.
So we're going to talk today about community health. That's the name of the program. So we'll kind of back up a little bit and hear more about your role. So in 2019, you became director of the Great Lakes Hub for the Johns Hopkins Center for Indigenous Health. What inspired you to take this role?
Oh, well, that word leadership that sort of comes with directing an office is one that I often shy away from. I don't know if others can relate to this, but it carries a lot of responsibility and it's scary to be the one in charge. And so I'll be honest with you, when the opportunity to join Johns Hopkins University, open up a satellite research office in Minnesota came up in 2019, I was really scared. And I have this amazing group of Indigenous women who are my friends, and we belong to this group called the Kwaypak. And we run together, we do physical activity together. And I was lamenting, oh my gosh, you know, I'm scared to take on this new role. And one of the Kwaypakers said, excuse me, who do you think you are? This is an incredible opportunity for all of us as Anishinaabe people. And go for it, girl. And so that was my real inspiration, was having these other Indigenous women pushing me to do more. And then at the same time, I had been already doing research with many communities across the region for, gosh, at that time it must have been 15 years. And we were ready to share what we were learning with other communities. So joining a bigger center was a great opportunity for us. I think it's important to share, there are significant resources at these institutions that I really want our community members to know that they have access to. And so if any listeners are interested in, you know, graduate level degrees in public health, there are some amazing fellowship programs. You can Google Bloomberg American Health Initiative at Johns Hopkins and check out those training programs and scholarship opportunities, because I really think that our community members have so much to offer these institutions of higher learning. And in turn, by getting degrees from some of these prestigious universities, it opens doors in this modern world for us to have impact. So encourage people to check it out if they're interested.
That's awesome. You started this position just before the pandemic started. So I'm wondering, did COVID-19 drastically shift the health needs and the priorities of the work and the projects that the center wanted to focus on at that time?
Yeah, it's a great question. So just to back up a little bit, the center that I'm a part of really has a variety of focal areas, and one of them happens to be infectious disease work. Our team came in 2019, as you pointed out, Dr. Stately, really focusing on chronic disease and behavioral health issues, as we call them. So mental health, substance use, so on and so forth. And honestly, in 2019, some of the early conversations we had were, do we really need this like infectious disease focus anymore? And oh my gosh, thank goodness we did have this team of experts, because in 2020, of course, the COVID-19 pandemic hit. Pandemics probably sadly are not going away. But our team's work in the spaces of mental health and substance use actually was amplified because, as I know you know, Dr. Stately, in the wake of this pandemic, the stresses associated with it, the losses, this has only exacerbated some of the issues that our communities face in these realms. And so I would say there was a bit of a shift or a maybe a reinforcement that what we already do needs to be done maybe in different ways and in better ways rather than totally shifting what we do.
Great. Well, when you think about what happened with COVID and the work at the center, what do you see as being long-term changes that the center addresses when it comes to the health needs of our communities?
You know, I've really been thinking hard about this very type of a question because the truth is there's 50, 60 years now of research in the name of addressing what used to be called health disparities. But more and more, I feel like we need to interrogate the ways in which we train people to do research and, you know, like what ways of knowing are privileged in the research enterprise in this world that we're in nowadays. And so for me, the big shift that I'm going through professionally and personally is really how can we leverage the resources of the university we work within, kind of the track record of doing research in this sort of Western way, to push for more community-driven, culturally grounded priorities. For me, I'm trying to use this position and our office to think through how do we just, as people say, sort of like the new thing is going back again. You know, going back to some of those original teachings and instructions and decolonizing my own brain, which is significantly colonized by these Western educational systems. Will I continue publishing papers? Yeah, because I can see they play a role in changing policy, for example. But there's something bigger here. Maybe in 5 years I'll know more what that looks like, but I do feel an arc in terms of my own professional life and what I want to invest time in.
Yeah, that's amazing. One of the things I think in this specific space, before I mention this other thing that I'm really excited about, is I want to acknowledge the role that you played in helping Boys Work establish like the ability to get their first harm reduction vending machine in their casinos and in their hotels, which is like such an amazing thing, right? So this is a place where I do a lot of my work within my own clinic, but also I amplify this in public spaces, the importance of being able to address the opiate use disorder epidemic and, you know, crisis that we have in our communities, being able to provide those tools to people in remote locations like in the middle of Boys Ward, but it's in the middle of the woods, right? And those are things that people need, and you were really instrumental in helping them get that. So I think that's profoundly impactful work that you do in that way. So I want to acknowledge that as well. One of the things people I'm hearing are getting really excited about a new paper that you all published on benevolent childhood experiences, an analyzation that began back in 2002. And of course, I saw you present on this specifically at the big conference last year at Mystic Lake. So can you give us a brief overview of that study and your findings? Because I think it's fascinating.
Sure. I can start with kind of an overview of the parent study, which is called Healing Pathways. And this is an ongoing project. It's a survey-based design with 8 different First Nations and reservation-based communities in the Midwestern U.S. and Canada. In 2002, we began by interviewing 746 kids who at that time were about 11 years old. And for 8 years, we interviewed them again and again and again. And we also talked to at least one of their parents or caregivers during that time. And then after 8 years, in about 2010, we paused the study. We thought, okay, that was 8 years. There's a lot of information here. We're good. About 6 years later, you know, I really heard a hungriness to find out what happened to these kids. So we got refunded in 2016 and we continued on and we went and relocated all of the kids we could find from the original study, who at that time, they were about 26, 27 years old. And we asked them all sorts of questions about what had happened since we saw them last, and then what's going on in their life now. And one of the things that we asked them about was this notion of benevolent childhood experiences. And lo and behold, the Kids in Healing Pathways reported higher rates of benevolent childhood experiences than comparison studies of non-Native kids. That's really cool. So I hope we get to measure more things like this as the study continues.
Awesome. What kinds of examples of benevolent childhood experiences floated to the top?
So benevolent childhood experiences comes from a broader literature related to really psychotherapy. And so we were using a measure really that was made for any kid to take. So it wasn't culturally tailored. So things like before the age of 18, did you have a neighbor who you really trusted? Or did you have a role model who you looked up to? Did you have at least one close caregiver who you felt very safe with? And what we found is like most of our kids reported experiencing all of them, all of these good things, like 80 some percent. And also related to that, the BCEs, the positive or the benevolent childhood experiences, washed out the effects of adverse childhood experiences in our statistical models. So this is a very hope-inspiring finding, this idea that even in the face of severe traumas as a child, if we can load kids up with these positive experiences, it's the protective effects can linger into adulthood.
Cool. So were there ways in which you used culturally appropriate research methods?
Yeah, Healing Pathways is built on this model of doing research that people call CBPR, or community-based participatory research. And, you know, this is an area that evolves over time. And I think Indigenous communities in the US, Canada, New Zealand, Australia really are leading the way in doing equity-driven, community-driven research. And CBPR is one example. So as an example, in all eight communities, we have co-leaders of the research team who lead with me. We collaborate. We decide what measures to include in our surveys, how to relocate the kids that we haven't talked to in years, who to hire to do the interviews, and really try to work on that power imbalance that is inherent in research when some of us are sitting at a university and others are sitting in their home community. How do you interrogate that? How do you work on that? How do you try to truly be an authentic partnership together? Everyone's talking now about data sovereignty and this idea that, you know, today, if you get funded to do research by the government, they expect you to share your data. And, you know, that's not appropriate for Native communities. It's up to each tribal nation to decide if they want to share their data. And so I'm really excited about what's happening on a national level to really double down on reinforcing tribal sovereignty in the space of research.
Great.
Awesome. How would you say, or how does this information and the way in which we gathered it, I guess, as well, help us understand the current state of health and well-being in Indigenous communities?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's actually, it's the thing I grapple with probably every day. Is this work that we're doing having any impact? Is it actually making any difference in the world? So I would say a few things. One is, I think the approach to doing research, and I talked about CBPR or tribally driven participatory research, sometimes matters more than the actual research. So one thing that we found over the years from the participants in Healing Pathways is that even they feel a sense of relationship to the people who interview them. And they report back to us that it has become a highlight of their life to once a year get to spill, you know, for like an hour, 2 hours, so much about their own life. They get to do this with an interviewer that has been visiting them since they were 11 years old. And those interviewers stay with the study because they get to lead and be a part of the leadership team of the study. They feel invested in it. They have designed it. It is theirs. And I don't think that would be true if we did this other type of research, you know, like helicopter research, where we swoop in, we bring in our own team to collect data in whatever way we want, and then we disappear forever. That's not going to have that impact. And so the how is critical. Then there's the what. What did you find? And I have noticed that some of the publications, which are all posted on a Healing Pathways website on our Johns Hopkins pages, you know, do all of them change the state of our health? No. But Some of them do. And an example of this is we've published about relocation programs. So families who went through these government-sponsored relocation programs of the 1950s and 60s in the US and Canada, how traumatic that actually was, and how that policy represents a form of historical trauma that continues to impact our communities. And we found that advocates were using that publication to help free children who had been put in cages at the border of the US and Mexico in recent years. You know, we all remember those images on the news. And I thought, what a beautiful thing. This work is helping other children to hopefully become treated like humans and like children. Relatedly, I see our own community partners using the findings to secure additional funds to do all sorts of cool programming. You know, there's some things that are a little kind of bigger picture, some much more local, and then some super relational. And all of it to me feels like you're in the right direction when things start to line up and it feels good inside.
Well, you hinted at some of those real world applications, but based on the study, what sort of steps can people take to leverage benevolent childhood experiences to help improve health outcomes?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, can we prevent ACEs from happening is a question. And of course, I think there's room for that. And we should definitely try to avoid ACEs in the first place and do whatever we can to protect kids. On the flip side, we can also, as I sort of mentioned earlier, we can boost up the good stuff in their lives when they're kids. I see communities doing this all the time. There's beautiful cultural programming. There's these grassroots culture camps that happen. There's, you know, special recognition for youth teams in different groups and schools, especially tribal schools. All of that stuff to me represents these positive childhood experiences that actually are culturally embedded. And so the next step actually for our study is that we have revised that original BCE measure, those positive childhood experiences, to be more culturally tailored so that we can see if the cultural groundedness of positive childhood experiences actually enhances the protective effects even further. And in which case, here we go again, you know, listen to our communities when we say culture is medicine, culture is treatment, culture is healing. And, you know, a concrete example of this to me in my own life with my own son, who's now 20 years old, it wasn't until he was 12 that he got to go through ceremony to learn what his Ojibwe name is. And his namesake said to him in that ceremony, "I am here for you always. I am someone you can always come back to and trust, and I will never judge you." And I just looked, I mean, I could tear up thinking about it, but what a beautiful way of being together. And I see our elders and our grandmas and our aunties doing this for kids all the time. I just think we don't always celebrate it or bring as much attention to it as we do to the negative side of things.
That's really beautiful.
Yeah, thank you. Anthony, I see you nodding your head a bit. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think that my own experience also with my own sons, tried to bring them around as many cultural activities as I possibly can. We take them to Sundance, we take them, you know, to other ceremonies. Last year, I took them to Sundance and they got their Dakota names. They were really proud to get those. And I said, these names are important because this is how your ancestors know you. They know who you are. When you need help and you need support and assistance from people and from ancestors that have already passed on, you know, this is how you refer to yourself. You'll call out to them. And then when you pass out of this world, that's how the ancestors will know who you are when you're back on that star path walking home. So it's really important and aligned really well with them. I think they're proud because they're strong names, right? So they were all excited about them, and they were really proud when I tattooed them on my arms. I mean, I think this is, like, as a child psychologist, which is what I am professionally, you know, we know that I think this is evidence that tells us, like, culture is prevention, culture, having that sense of belongingness, like, we know, like, there's somebody out there that loves me, or there's a group of somebodies that love me, take care of me, protect me, well, and someplace I can always, a touchstone I can always return to, which is really important for all of us and our mental well-being, emotional and spiritual well-being. I guess the last question that I have really is like, tell us your story, your ideas about how you see these results informing our understanding of resilience and positive development in families, in communities, in nations, right?
You know, I always say that, especially to people who are like outside of Indigenous or American Indian health contexts, I always say that the work we do is for us, but what we learn has relevance really for all humanity. And I think the feelings of disconnection that we see across our country and maybe even the entire planet, the things we see with climate change, the mental health of our kids in the wake of COVID especially, and you just alluded to some of those challenging dynamics. You know, those stresses hit our communities the hardest, and if it were not for these amazing protective effects of what I really have found through a lot of work, including with Healing Pathways, to be culturally embedded, we would be in even worse shape. I mean, it's a wonder that we persist and in many cases thrive given all that we've been through. And I really believe it is because of those cultural strengths. I mentioned as I introduced myself that my dad's side of the family is white. It's a German-Swedish mix. And you know, about 5 years ago, I really went through some significant life events to try to learn about that side of the family and where did they come from and what does that mean for me to be both colonized and colonizer. And honestly, for me, it was a very healing journey and one that gave me more compassion for all of humanity, but also, and you know, sort of gave me the the guts to stand up to some of this oppressive stuff in a new way. So how all of this work kind of informs health more broadly, I think it just offers so many teachings about those pathways to walking in a good way, to living in a good way, if only we would listen. And we, I mean, the collective of humanity, we only end up with an abundance narrative and there's nothing to fight about because, you know, Creator gave us all the things to be well. And, you know, that's a kind of a big, like big picture story, big picture message for everyone, that embedded in these, you know, research reports are little nuggets of wisdom that put all together just remind us all to remember our responsibilities to each other and to more than humans out there and take care of each other. And we find that indeed leads to better health outcomes, even around the pandemic, even around some of these adverse childhood experiences.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Melissa Walls, for joining us. Congratulations on the publication.
Thank you so much. It's fun to talk to you both.
All right. Dr. Melissa Walls, very fun interview.
Sure was. A great conversation. Very insightful. I think profound findings in that study. So I'm really excited about that.
Well, as we finish up our conversation, that also finishes up our season here for Community Health Conversations. It's been lovely chatting with you all these episodes, all these conversations, Dr. Stately.
I know, it's awesome. It's hard to believe we're at the end, though, also. You know, this is one of the things I look forward to every single month, is spending time with you, talking to amazing people. Thanks for being a great host. I'm Dr. Anson Stately.
And I'm Leah Lem, Gigawabman, and we wish you health.
Minnesota Native News Community Health Conversations is supported by the Minnesota Department of Health. Find information about COVID vaccines and boosters online at mn.gov/COVID-19. Find more of our conversations at minnesotanativenews.org/community-conversations.
KFAI is proud to present Music on the Cortile at the Landmark Center in downtown St. Paul. Music on the Cortile presents live performances by talented local musicians. Taking